Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater, and your moderator for this morning. Today is Sunday, June 2nd, 2024. The share ID numbers for Friday, May 31st, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 21,450. That's 21,450. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 21,451. That's 21,451. This morning, A Vision for You presents the Program of Recovery, Start of Summer Q&A. We come to Overeaters Anonymous as a result of the suffering and the frustration we experienced in our disease of compulsive overeating. We felt hopelessness when we tried to control our problems with food and eating. We felt despair, trying every diet and used many methods to control our compulsive overeating without success. We could not enjoy life because of our obsession with food and with weight. We could not stop eating too much, even when we really wanted to. We felt shame and humiliation about our behavior with food. We cannot solve the problem by ourselves. We come to Overeaters Anonymous looking for a way out, a solution which will free us from the bondage of our disease. The Big Book was written as a set of directions for doing the 12 steps quickly and effectively. It's not a book of theory or philosophy. It offers a clear step-by-step approach for your recovery. It enables us to really and fully understand the twofold nature of our problem. It presents a clear, practical solution to the problem, and it shows us how to implement that solution through the 12-step program of action it describes. The 12 steps, as outlined in the Big Book, represent a process of spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient to overcome compulsive overeating. We submit to a simple process that certainly is not easy, yet it takes us to a place we've never been. Joining us this morning is Harlan G., a recovered compulsive overeater from Scottsdale, Arizona. Harlan's a loyal servant of Overeaters Anonymous, a beloved member of A Vision for You, and dedicated to carrying the message of recovery around the globe. It's always a pleasure. It's always a delight, and with great excitement and honor to welcome Harlan G. Good morning, Harlan.
Good morning, Leah. Thank you very much, and it is an honor to be here of service, and thank you so much. I am Harlan. I am a compulsive overeater indeed, and I am from Scottsdale, Arizona. However, today I'm in Arlington Heights, and I'm visiting. And so I'm out of the heat of Arizona for a little while here. So very glad to be here this morning. I have been a compulsive overeater where weight and food intake have been the topic du jour my entire life. I have very vivid memories of people screaming and yelling at my mother and father from the time I was a child about how much food I of teachers and I have memories of doctors and dentists and everybody just wailing on my mother and father about how fat I was getting and what are they going to do about this and what are they going to, you know, how are they going to curb my appetite, et cetera, et cetera. And they didn't, my mother and father didn't have any more answers than they had about how to get to the moon. And I'm just going to give you the Cliff's Notes version of my story because I do want to get the Q&A. But I do want to let you know that by the time I was 7 years old for sure, I was trying as best I could to acquiesce to the demands of a world that did not accept me. The world sent me a very clear signal from a very, very early age that if you are fat, you are completely, utterly, totally, existentially unacceptable. that they would warn me that if you're a fat boy, you're never going to get a girlfriend. If you're a fat boy, you're never going to play on the team. If you're a fat boy, you're never going to get a good job, and on and on and on. And so I got a clear signal from the world that if you are fat existentially, you are unacceptable. And by the time I was 7, I was trying to diet, but I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. And then I have a memory that when I was 9 years old, I was at the doctor's office, Dr. Jacobson on Devon in Milwaukee, in Chicago. I'm born and raised in Chicago. He put me on diet pills, and it said on the bottle to curb your appetite. And I took these diet pills, and it did indeed curb my appetite. It did indeed kill completely my desire for food, and I lost weight. But the problem is that these amphetamines, these heavy-duty amphetamines, wreak havoc in my brain. I can't even describe to you what it's like to be on these pills if you've never been on them. You're on these pills and you're not eating, that's good, but you can't function. You just can't function. You sleep about maybe 20 minutes a month, and because you're not sleeping, you're susceptible to every cold, every flu, every strep throat, everything you could possibly imagine, because you're not sleeping. You're not helping your immune system when you take these pills, that's for sure. And when you take them, you can't really hear what anybody's saying to you. You just can't. And I get accused of this now, saying the same thing like 3 million times. Like I would say something and again, just say the same thing. And it became very, very terrible, just very terrible. And then they took me off those pills and they put me on another pill when I was about 10. And same results. Just horrible. When puberty hit, by the time puberty hit around 12, around 13 years old, I didn't look like the other boys. I couldn't wear the clothes the other boys wore. When girls were around, they didn't laugh at my jokes. They didn't touch me. They did nothing like that. And it was very tough. It was very hard. And it wreaked havoc in my life. And I was emasculated by this disease. I was physically emasculated. I was emotionally emasculated by a disease that I didn't know I had. And if I did know I had a disease, I couldn't have done anything about it because I didn't know how to plug in to the power. I didn't know how to plug in to any type of program. I just thought I was weak and I was stupid and I lacked willpower. And I lacked discipline, and I didn't care about my mother, and I didn't care about my life, and I didn't care about my father. Why did I think those things? Because those things were the things I was told by every well-intentioned adult in my environment, that if I cared, if I wanted to live a good life, I would stop eating so much. The only problem is I was being told this by people who had no more of an idea that this is a disease than they do how to teach a golden retriever how to play the trombone. They just didn't understand that I was suffering from a disease, and I was emasculated by this disease, and I was stomped on by this disease. And when this disease was done stomping on me and beating me into oblivion, it set me on fire. And every dream that you're supposed to dream, every aspiration that you're supposed to have as a young man was not to be mine. I couldn't dream about going to faraway colleges. I couldn't dream about girlfriends, wives, families, careers, because I was so morbidly obese. I'll give you some statistics. I do want to cut this short, this part of it short. I was 335 pounds as a senior in high school. I was 500 pounds by the time I was a sophomore in college. I was 600 pounds by the time I was a graduate of college, and I was later to become about 700 pounds. So this is my life. This is the trajectory, but there's more to it than just what I weighed. There's the filth and the squalor that I lived in. there is the economic stress of having a food habit in the 1970s, a food habit of about $100 to $150 a day, writing bad checks, lying when the truth would have served me better, living in filth, not taking care of myself, no hygiene, no teeth brushing, no nothing. And I was living to eat. I was absolutely living to eat. I couldn't go to the movies because I couldn't fit in the seats. I couldn't wear underwear. I had towels shoved between layers of flab to keep the skin from rubbing together. The contact dermatitis was an unbelievable part of this disease that not a lot of people have, so you don't hear it talked about. But the rubbing together of the skin between my thighs, the rubbing together of the skin on my stomach hung down almost to my knees. The unbelievable pain, the physical pain that the edema in my lower extremities produced was unbelievable. I couldn't stand, I couldn't sit, I couldn't walk. I couldn't be comfortable, and death would have been a blessing. And I begged God for death every day of my life. I did not want to live in this world because existentially I was wrong. And the last ostracizable American is the obese. The last ostracizable American is the obese. You cannot walk up to people and be politically correct if you make fun of them for their religion, hopefully, or their race, or their creed, or their orientation, or their taste, or whatever it is. But if a person is obese, I was absolutely open game for every Tom, Dick, and Harry with a wisecrack. Children would laugh at me in public. Adults would laugh at me in public. I was an object of ridicule, and I thought to myself, you guys talk about God in the synagogue, and you talk about God in the church, and you talk about God all over the place. Where was God for me? I was an object of ridicule. I was an object of absolute exclusion from the mainstream of life. I could not live a life like I saw other people living. I saw people, they appeared normal to me, and I knew that I was not. And the only thing that gave me respite from this pain was the very substance that was killing me, and that was a Chips Ahoy cookie or an Almond Joy bar. Because for 10 seconds, when I ate a piece of pizza, the world was a beautiful place. I liken it to the Wizard of Oz, and the monkeys scared the daylights out of me when I saw that movie as a kid. They still do, I got to tell you. But when Dorothy lands in Oz, her world goes from a sepia gray, a black and white kind of sepia gray, and then all of a sudden I eat an Almond Joy bar, all of a sudden I eat a piece of pizza, and the world goes to the most beautiful technicolor that you ever saw in your life. And for about 9 or 10 seconds, when that Almond Joy bar, Chips Ahoy, whatever it is, peanut butter and jelly sandwich, when it was in my mouth, the world was beautiful. The only problem is, what I didn't understand is that when that was in my mouth, it was triggering an involuntary, automatic, absolutely reliable physical allergy to eat more and more and more and more. So the more I ate, the more I wanted, the more I wanted, the more I ate, the more I ate, the more I wanted, and it was just endless. And there was no hope for me. My mother and father were older. My dad was 54 years old on the day that I was born. And my father was the sole survivor of murder and mayhem in Europe that you should never see or never know from. His family was obliterated off the face of the earth. He, at 14 years old, came to this country in 1914, and he made a life for himself. Didn't speak a word of English, didn't know anything, just didn't know a thing. He was 14, he made a life, and I got born, and in every way that I can imagine, I am a survivor of survivors. I am the dream of those who were murdered before me. I am their dream. I am their aspiration. And I was just making a mockery out of my life, just a mockery out of my life. And one of the challenges that I have even today is to come to peace with the decades of my life that were lost to me through this disease. And I'm reminded on page 124, I read this every day, cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. I lived a terrible, terrible existence. I have friends. They were loyal to me. I was loyal to them. We loved each other. But when I went on my first date with a girl, I was 35 years of age. It was a nightmare of an existence. In 1979, on February the 2nd, months after my father died, my mother died when I was 22, my father died when I was 24. Months after my father died, two well-intentioned friends, actually one was a mother of one of my friends and her friend. So these were people that were older than I. They burst into my filthy, dirty apartment and pushed their way where the rent had not been paid. They pushed their way past the Twinkie wrappers, past the Chips Ahoy bags, past the pizza boxes, and dragged me by the ear to a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. I lived in Chicago, but this was in Skokie, Illinois, at the Orchard Mental Health Center. Orchard Mental Health Center. See, God likes to laugh too. But anyway, I went there. It was a Friday night in 1979. February 2nd was a Friday night, unless my memory is worse than I think. It was a Friday night, freezing cold, ice up to your ears, snow up to your ears, miserable, miserable February evening. And I went to the meeting and I looked at my shoes. And when I looked up, I saw people that were 30 years older than me. I was 24 years old at the time and weighed very normal weights. There were a couple of people in there that were slightly overweight, but nobody was even close to the weight that I was carrying, not even close. And I heard some things. I stuck around for a while. I stopped smoking. I don't know how many people stopped smoking by coming to OA, but I did. And then I left. I graduated. I had figured I'd lost a little weight. I got this down to a science. I'm out of here. A couple years later, I'm back, heavier than I've ever been in my entire life. And I was barely able to get in and out of a car by this time. I was barely able to, just barely able to function. I came back and I realized that this was my only hope. And for the only time in my life, I entertained the idea of seeing what life could be like if I were to really give this a try. And God whispered on the ember of my heart that was not black from being burnt out. He whispered on the ember of my heart, and it burst into flames. And for the only time in my life, I started to want to live and want to see who and what I could be. And I worked the program of recovery. I was to have one more relapse and one more recovery in me. But to make a very long and drawn-out story that you can hear on other Vision recordings and other recordings that I do, I am today 25 years abstinent. I am today with 45 years in this program. I love this way of life. I have a life that's worth living today. I have someone in my life that I'm crazy about. I have someone in my life that I just absolutely am nuts about. I have friends. I'm still working, unfortunately. I wish I could retire, but I can't right now. But I my home is mine. I mean, I pay a mortgage, but it's my house. My car is paid for. I have no debt. I owe nobody any money. Money for me was a big factor in this because I wrote a lot of bad checks and didn't pay my bills, et cetera, et cetera. I have excellent credit today. I bought cars without putting down the change in my pocket. I have excellent credit today. I have a life that works. I have a life of service. And in every way that I can imagine, I am being of maximum service to God and the people about me. And I have fulfilled the dream of those who died before me with a dream in their heart that one day I would make them proud. One day I would make a difference. And I think to the best of my ability, I have made a difference. If I go tonight, I think that I've left a footprint on OA to the best of my ability. And I think that that this is the greatest way of life imaginable. I do want to tout, before I stop my story and begin the Q&A, I do want to say that a number of years ago, a friend of mine that lives in New York, who's not really around anymore, encouraged me to come to something called a Vision for You phone meeting. I was not a big believer in phone meetings at that time. I was a live meeting guy. I'm very old school. You want to go to a meeting, you get your tuchus up, you get into your clothes, you go in the car, you get to the meeting. Well, this was an amazing, amazing recovery, just amazing meeting, this Vision for You. And I have been a very loyal devotee of a Vision for You ever since that day. It's been my honor and privilege to serve a Vision for You in my way of doing Q&A, in my way of doing special editions. It is the greatest renaissance of OA that I've ever seen. And OA, I believe today, is where it is in a good way because of a Vision for You. A Vision for You has elevated the recovery level and the recovery rate from within OA, and it is a healthy OA meeting. I hear this about, I want to get a Vision sponsor, I want to get a Vision this or a Vision that. A Vision for You is a part of OA. It is not a part from OA. It is a part of OA, and it is a very good example of a healthy OA meeting, and there is a lot of recovery here. If you're new, if you're struggling, if you're wondering, is this the right place for you? In my opinion, if you are a compulsive overeater, yes, it is the best of places for you. It is magnificent. It is just magnificent. And I tell this to Leah and Melanie all the time, the sun will never set on the work that they've done. So anyway, I'm hearing some background noise. I guess that may be my signal to stop doing my story. I have lost a little over 500 pounds. I'm in the low twos. I walk 3 miles a day, 6 days a week. I have a life that works, and I have a life that is full of God and full of people. And my belief in God and my belief in the power of God and the power of God as it manifests through these 12 steps is an unshakable faith. I never have to wonder again, is there a God and does this work? All right, what I'd like to do now, 5 minutes longer than I wanted to take on this, but okay. This is the Cliff Notes version of my story. Let's throw it open to Q&A because that's really why we're here. Leah. Hello. Leah?
Thank you, Harlan.
You there?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right. And before sure. we throw it open, let me just reiterate this. Food questions, please. My food plan should not be of interest to you. Your food plan is not of interest to me. I will talk about generalities, but no food, and for God's sakes, no math. Okay, let's throw
exactly.
it
exactly. No food questions, no math questions.
No math.
All right.
No math.
Who has a question for Harlan today?
Pete B.
Star 1 to unmute.
Loretta.
Felicia F.
Gotcha, Felicia.
Me F.
I didn't catch your first name.
Me F.
Ooh, I can't hear that at all.
All right, we'll work on that. Monique, I believe. Anyone else want to get in this group? Star star 1 to unmute to pose a question. Great opportunity.
Leah S.
Good morning, Leah. Okay, let's get started with Pete B., please.
Thanks, Leah, for your service. You do such a great job. And Harlan, thank you so much for all of the service that you bring to Overeaters Anonymous. You have provided me with countless hours of contemplating the content of our literature and your ability.
Can you hear me okay?
You're having an echo. It's like you're,
Let's see how it goes. Anyway, your ability to recall dates and data points is just unbelievable. I can't even remember my kids' names half the time. But anyway, here's my question. It has to do with step 10.
Okay.
The instructions in the big book for step 5 indicate that a solitary self-appraisal never suffices. Seldom suffices.
Right.
Again,
seldom
that's
suffices,
the instructions for step 5.
Right.
In step 10, it says that our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And in the AA 12 and 12, it says that the ability to make accurate self-appraisal is a habit that we have to develop. So my question is, how is somebody supposed to develop the habit of accurate self-appraisal if the instructions we give people is for them to reach out to another human being to help them understand their emotions and process them effectively?
Okay. Let's take a look, first of all, at just the big book. The 12 and 12 is great. I'm never going to disparage it, the AA 12 and 12. But let's take a look at page 14. And at the bottom of page 14 is what I call Ebby's legacy. And it teaches us that through sponsoring other people, we grow and we perfect and enlarge our spiritual life. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative. Imperative obviously means important above all else to work with others as he had worked with me. Let's stop right there for just a second. When I work with others, my understanding of who I am, what I am, grows exponentially. And so I'm never able to make a solitary self-appraisal. But God comes to me most often through others. And when God speaks to me through others, when my understanding grows, my ability to function in the recovery This is not a program of knowing or understanding, but my understanding makes my faith grow, and my faith makes my life better. I hope that makes sense. So let's take a look at what it also says here. Faith without works was dead, he said. And it also occurs to me that works without faith is dead. That's very important, too. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And if he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. So the statement in the big book stands as true that a solitary self-appraisal proved insufficient. But when my exposure to others through step 10s, through step 5s, through the various things that come up through sponsorship, it brings me closer to God. And when I get closer to God, my recovery is elevated and exponentially improved. So, yes, the statement is a solitary self-appraisal proved insufficient. But as I grow in the program, my faith, my closeness to God brings me to a level of consciousness never before experienced. And I hope that answers it.
Thank you, Pete B., for your question. Next up, Loretta H., your question, please.
Loretta.
Good morning, Harlan and Leah and all of you, along with my precious God. You are saving my life with your service. Loretta H. recovered in North Carolina. Okay, this kind of goes back to your step 10s. I go through, how many times have you gone through the total step? Because, and this, I don't know if I'm asking because I don't do it that way, but each time I have an 11 or 10 problem, I usually try to do this with a sponsee I'm going through on my part of that. So do you understand? I'm Italian.
No.
A little bit. No?
No, I don't understand the question. No.
Okay. I go through the steps usually every time a protege, I don't even call them sponsees, goes through the steps. Do you do that, or have you just done one 4-step in your entire recovery?
Oh, no, I do 4 steps a lot. I do 4 steps because as my life changes, as things come up, I have to do 4 steps on things because recovery for me is not an event that one 4-step is going to tackle. Recovery is a journey. Recovery is not a destination. It's a journey. And what happens to me, I don't know how it is for anyone else, things that have nothing to do with my intake of food come up. I would say that for the first several years of my program, it was, imagine in your mind right now, like a monster. Don't eat, go to meetings, don't eat, go to meetings, don't eat, go to meetings. That's the first few years of program for me. And then all of a sudden, I didn't realize what a selfish person I was. I didn't realize what a frightened, angry person, jealous person I was. I didn't realize how self-centered I was. And when I say was, it's wishful thinking because I am still that person, but I have to work at it. I have to work at considering other people first. That is so foreign to my nature. Every day I try to exemplify to a person that I love that they matter to me, listening to what they're saying and putting them first. That is not my nature. That is not who I am. So 4 steps for me as time goes on mean something much deeper and much richer. For the longest time, I have been working on coming to grips with the decades of my life that I wasted in the garbage can. How do I come to grips with the first many, many years of my life going in the garbage can? The dreams that I didn't that I couldn't dream or fulfill. So that was something that I wrote my hands off, did many 4 steps on that. Now I'm working on some of my anger, some of my jealousy, some of my, the passive aggressive tendencies that I have. I'm working on that. I'm working on how to be in a healthy relationship. So as time goes on, issues change. So to think that I'm just going to do 1 4-step for me is laughable. And what is on page 84, the first sentence of step 10? This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue, the word continue is in this paragraph 4 times, continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. So the first part of the sentence is continue to take personal inventory. So I do lots of 4 steps because sometimes a 10th step doesn't quite get me where I need to be. So the answer, if I'm understanding you right, Loretta, and I think I am, do I just do 1 4-step? Heck no. I've done hundreds of them. You can ask my sponsor in California. I've done them, with him, and I've done – so, no, I don't just do 1 4-step. That's not going to – because issues change as life changes. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Loretta H., for your question.
Great
and
answer.
Next,
it solved it. Thank you.
Next up, Felicia F. Your question, please.
Felicia S. from New Jersey. grateful, recovered, compulsive overeater. Sorry. Thank you so much, Harlan and Leah. I consider you both angels with skin on that the God of my understanding sent to help. And you've made a tremendous difference in my recovery, even if I don't know you directly. My question for you, Harlan, is currently today, you've been abstinent and recovered for a long time. Today, could you take us through what your 11-step practice looks like today? Thank you.
I'm reticent to answer specifically what my 11-step looks like because it tends to create more problems than it solves. What I'm going to do, Felicia, is I'm going to answer a question that you didn't ask, and I hope it'll be okay. How did I get to my 11th step as it is today? That's something I want to answer, because if I give you what I do for my 11th step, it's not going to compare to somebody else's 11th step, and then we're going to have a controversy. It first started out for me as praying prayers from my religion of childhood and some different things from my childhood that may or may not be applicable to you. I also do big book stuff. I read things out of the big book. And the primary source of my 11th step is material both in the first 164 pages of the big book and in a story in the back of the big book, which is very pertinent for me to live in today. I also start out years and years ago going online, literally going online when it was the 1990s and I got my first computer. There are guided meditations on there, and I started with those, and then I started adapting those meditations to things that I wanted to say that were giving me comfort. So it was trial and error. And every once in a while, I'm lucky enough, I'm very, very lucky, I do my 11th step with a partner. I do my 11th step with someone else in the morning. And that really, for me, it enhances it just in so many ways. It brings us together, me and this other person, closer together. And I feel that in praying with somebody else, it brings me closer to God. So I did it with trial and error. There are certain prayers in the big book that if you go online and you AA prayers or big book prayers, adapt some of those to your life. Which ones do you feel more close to than others? And then maybe look at some other things, not OA related, maybe things from your religion. Or if you don't have a religion that you feel particularly close to, maybe some things you could read that are inspiring, things that you feel will build you up and get you closer to God. Those are the things I would strongly suggest. But step 11 is extremely important. It is extremely vital, but you have to develop it, Felicia, according to what speaks to your heart rather than what speaks to my heart. So I hope that helps.
Thank you, Felicia S., for your question. Next up, Monique. I believe we had a Monique. Is that correct? Star one to unmute.
Hi, this is Nick F. in Tennessee. Hi, Harlan. Thank you so much for your story and sharing it, just how you shared it, sir. My question is two of them, if that's okay. One is, do you ever feel sorry for yourself for having to do this work? And the other one is, did you balk at We Agnostics?
No, I didn't balk at We Agnostics. I'm not an agnostic. An agnostic is someone who does not have enough knowledge. Ag means without, Gnostic means knowledge. And where a lot of people struggle with this God thing is here. You do not have to have, Nick, you do not have to have this understanding of God. You do not have to become a theologian. You do not have to become a clergy person, you do not. And a lot of people struggle with this idea of God. I'm going to break it down very simple term. Do you believe, or are you willing to believe, that there is a power greater than yourself? And if you are willing to believe, or if you do believe that there is a power greater than yourself, page 47, it's echoed on page 12. If you can just be willing to believe, Nick, that there is a power greater than yourself, that is all the understanding of God you need to do this program. I do not have to know exactly how many people were at Mount Sinai. I do not exactly have to know how many people were crossing the Red Sea. I do not have to know all the laws of the Old Testament or the New Testament. I do not have to have that understanding. What I need is a willingness to believe, or a belief, that there is a power greater than myself. Now, as I look on my life, here is what I can definitely tell you. I, of myself, am not able to fend off this disease. I am not able to control the amount I eat once I've started, and I am not able to stay out of the food now that I've put it down. I have to be willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself. And I'll leave you with this thing that works for me. There are two things that I need to know about God, Nick. Two, just two. There is one, and it's not me. There is one, and it's not me. Forget this, we agnostics, and forget this stuff about confusion. And waiting for God to come down and give you the number for Powerball so you can win. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. There is a God. It's not me. And all I need to be willing to do is believe that there is a power greater than myself, and I choose to call that power God. You can choose that, call that power doorknob, dog, if you're dyslexic, whatever you want. There's nobody here to tell you what you should believe or what you, whatever. It's up to you. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Nick F., for posing your questions today. And next up, Leah S., your question, please.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Leah M. Thank you, Harlan. And thank you, everyone behind the scenes. My name is Leah S., and I'm in Brooklyn, New York. My question to you, Harlan, is, after sponsees have finished the 12 steps, or even as you or as the sponsor supposes, you know, go ahead and you can sponsor as you are up to the 10 step or whichever the sponsor decides. Mm-hmm. And then a month passes and these people call you back. What is your take on that?
Okay, first of all, I have my people that I sponsor call me every day, and it doesn't matter where they are in the process. I don't care if I'm out of town. I don't care if I'm in a hospital. I have taken sponsee calls 20 minutes after getting to my room after knee replacements and hip replacements. It doesn't matter. We talk every day. We don't talk at length at certain times, but I ask them, how you doing? What's going on? What are you going to do for yourself? What are you going to do for others? What is it you don't want to tell me? What is it? What's going on in your life? What are you going to do for yourself? What are you going to do for others? I want to know what your game plan is. And if they have problems with a sponsee, they will discuss them with me as well. So I do not subscribe to this idea that I cut you loose. I take newer people through the steps, so I keep my program green, but I don't just throw them out of the nest once we're at a certain point. They still call me every day. They talk to me about the people they're sponsoring. They talk to me about what's going on. What are they going to do for themselves? What are they going to do for others? And that's how we do it.
Thank you, Leah S., for your question this morning. All right. Who else has a question for Harlan? Star 1 to
Hannah S.
Who is this, Larry?
Hannah S.
Hannah S. Yeah, Larry K. Good morning.
Maura
Who else?
Roz
Maura?
G.
Roz.
Vanessa G.
Melissa C.
Vanessa. Melissa.
Cheryl A.
Cheryl A.
Connie G.
Connie G.
Jordan L.
Jordan L.
Good morning. Good morning.
Okay, that's a good list. I've got Hannah S., Larry K., Maura Z., Roz G., Vanessa G., Melissa C., Cheryl A., Connie G., and Jordan L. Just a reminder, no questions regarding food plans, nor any math questions.
No math. No math.
No math.
No food, no,
no
math.
No food, no math. Okay, Hannah, you're up. What's your
Thank
question?
You very much. Thank you, Harlan, very much. I have a question. I don't think it's just a question that it pertains to me solely. So let's say, so Vision is really, it's a meeting. It's not a group. There are other food programs you can go. They have their meetings. They have their groups. So you could do the meeting. You could get a sponsor in Vision. You could go to a meeting or all the meetings for that matter. But how do you, some there, you know, places where, I'm sure this isn't going to be a shock, that OA is not necessarily that strong. So what do you do if you're living somewhere where there's not strong OA, but you need that face-to-face fellowship, working through this together with people? I know sometimes people go to AA but I'm just wondering what you suggest.
You bring yourself to that meeting and you carry physically your big book. Whenever you walk into that meeting, you may be the only copy of the big book, Hannah, that they will ever see. Let them see what this program is doing for you. Do not wait to see what it's going to do for someone else to make the meeting strong. John F. Kennedy, when he was getting inaugurated in 1960, he said, ask not what this country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. This is exactly the same. You don't look at anyone else's program in there. You come in there with what you know from Vision. You bring your recovery to that meeting and let God do the rest. The meeting will either succeed and flourish or it will not. That will not be up to us because we are not in the results business. We are in the business of carrying a message. The results are up to God. So you carry your big book and you carry yourself and show them, don't tell them, show them what the Vision meetings and the big book and God and recovery are doing, and they're all synonymous to me with God. But you show them what it's doing for you. Let them come to you so you can tell them, yes, I go to a Vision for you. Yes, I work the steps out of the big book. Yes, I have recovery. Be that beacon of hope. St. Francis of Assisi said, preach the gospel, and only if you must use words. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Hannah S. And next up, Larry K. Good morning.
Larry K., oh, my God.
With a Cubs trivia question, I bet. Cubs trivia.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask.
I'm up for it. I'm up
I was
going
to ask about the mathematical capability of the Cubs to pull this off, but I don't think that's allowed. So let me ask a different question, Harlan. Thanks for your service this morning. So I'm just going to read to you from page 62 and just ask for your comment. You've had a few years around this deal, working this deal. So on page 62, the text explains that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And I'll just stop with that sentence. Can you comment on that, Harlan, just in a broad sense or however you want to take it?
Okay. Thanks, Larry. We are ego-driven people. We are ego-driven humans. And selfishness, the script that we have for the world, and self-centeredness is a part of, unfortunately, who we are. Let's take a look at page 570 of the big book in the fourth edition. 570 is part of the medical view of AA, and it is on page 570 at the top that we see these words. I'm not reading the first sentence. I'm reading Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous are no crusaders. So if you're on page 570, I hope you're at those words. Not a temperance society. They know that they must never drink. They help others and with similar. They help others with similar problems. In this atmosphere, the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive concentration upon himself. Learning to depend upon a higher power and absorb himself in his work with other alcoholics, he remains sober day by day. The days add up into weeks, the weeks into months and years. So on page 62, we see these words, selfishness dash self-centeredness. We have to break that down. The more self-centered I am, the more removed from my God I become. The more others-centered, in a healthy way, I'm going to get to that in a second, the closer to God that I get. Now, there is healthy service and there is sick service. What is the difference? If I'm doing something for you with an expectation of a return, that is not service. That is manipulation. Okay, that is manipulation. I'll give you a dime, but I expect you to give me a dollar. Not service. When I give from the heart, and I don't mention it. If I mention it, if I throw it in your face, it is not only as if I didn't do it, it's actually worse. Because what I'm doing now is I'm creating a burden of guilt on the other person. And I have to be very, very careful with this. I have to do and shut up about it. In a pamphlet that OA had 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it was a little pamphlet, said something about I'm going to dress becomingly, Abraham Lincoln says most people are about as happy as they make up their minds to be. Some of you have the pamphlet. I don't remember the name of it, honestly. I haven't seen the pamphlet in 30 years. But there's a line in there, in this little pamphlet that OA had, and it says, today, oh yeah, just for today was the name of it, I think. Don't ask me where to get it because I don't know. I would assume OA.org. But in this pamphlet, it says, today, I will do something for someone else and not get found out. Isn't that something? And it makes me feel better. For me, this is a disease of self-loathing. It is not just a disease of food. It is a disease of self-hatred. It is a disease of isolation. It is a disease of many other facets of life. When I am able to give, I hate myself a little less. And when I'm able to do it again, I hate myself even less. So today, when I see myself in a mirror or a storefront, I don't hate what I see. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm narcissistic. It just means that I'm at peace with who I am and what I am. And what I have to remember that recovery is about my relationship with God. I get to that relationship with God when I ask myself, how do I find God? And for me, how I find God is in the face of one of his suffering children. And when I'm able to give of myself, that brings me closer to God and further away from Dunkin' Donuts. Thanks, Larry. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Larry K. And next, we have Maura Z with a question, followed by Roz G.
Good morning, Leah. Thank you so much for your service, Maura Z. I'm gratefully recovering today in Virginia. Thank you, Harlan, for all of your service that you do. I greatly appreciate you. I have a question that's on page 76, about step six. And I've had this conversation several times with different people over the years. And I get different answers. The book tells us that we simply ask the question of, am I ready to let God remove from us all these things which we have admitted are objectionable? Do I do anything? Because my thought has always been, oh, okay, there it goes.
Nope. If you're taking step six and it's taking you more than about 15 seconds, you're doing it incorrectly. What step six simply is you're looking at your fourth step. You've just given your fifth step. You've taken an hour of quiet time. You're looking at the destruction of your lives and the lives of those around you who you love or who you're close to or some that you're not so close to. And you've seen the destruction of life. Do you want to keep living this way or not? No? Then do the seven-step prayer and move on with your life. In our zeal to overcomplicate, overthink, overdo, to create mountains of molehills, we want to go, and I'm not knocking Drop the Rock. I'm not saying it's a bad book. It's fine. You know, there's nothing in here that says after reading other books, after doing writing, here are the steps that require written attention. 4, 8, and sometimes 9. That's it. 4, 8, and sometimes 9. There's no writing involved in step 6. There's no contemplating. You look at the fourth step. You say, do I want to live this way? No. If you still want to live this way, lying, cheating, whatever, you ask God to help you be willing. You read the seven-step prayer, and you move on with your life. If the whole 6-7 takes more than a minute, you're doing it incorrectly. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Maura Z, for your question. Now we have Roz G, followed by Vanessa G.
Roz G. Okay.
Hi, Harlan. Hi, everybody. Roz
Hi,
G,
Roz.
Recovered compulsive overeater here. Harlan, I would like for you to generalize. It's June, and it's vacation time. I'm going to be going to Mexico next week, and I'm sure a lot of us have vacation plans. And how can we work a good OA program while on vacation?
Well, I'm on vacation now, and we go to the grocery store, and we cook, and we shop, and we do the things we need to do to keep me and keep my program number one in my life. I always have to remember that this is numero uno in my life without exception. There is no such thing for this disease. There is no vacation. There is no out of town. There is no nothing. The disease will pounce on me in the atypical as well as the typical. If I'm going to say to myself, I'm on vacation, so I can eat this, I can eat there, I can do this, I'm dead. I'm dead. Yes, we eat out. Yes, but it's very sparingly, and we shop, we cook, we do what we need to do here. So my greatest advice is keep program first. How good is a vacation if I'm gorging myself with food? Very good. Not very good. I'm going to come back miserable. I'm going to come back scared to see people. I'm going to come back in the arms of the disease. Why do I want to do that to myself? What's fun about that? Really and truly, what's fun about that? I'm in Greater Chicago right now. There is no better food town than Chicago, Illinois. I'm sorry. It beats the daylights out of anything you could ever imagine. Pizza, hot dogs, Italian beef. You name the cuisine, we have it here, and it is fantastic. There's no greater food town in this world than Chicago, Illinois. and I'm right outside of it. I'm across from Poop Park. But the bottom line is my recovery has to supersede anything else. So keep it green. Sponsor while you're out of town. Do what you need to do. And remember that it is absolutely imperative that we keep our program numero uno. Thanks, Roz. I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roz G. Now we have Vanessa G. followed by Melissa C.
Hi, Leah. Hi, Harlan. Thank you guys so much for bringing this program to me, making it come alive. Harlan, maybe when I was less than 6 weeks out of the food, I was in the middle of step nine, and I was asked by a different fellow to sponsor her. I was a little concerned about it, and my sponsor suggested I send you an email. I sent you an email, and you came back with three words. You are ready. And I started sponsoring, and I think that, you know, by extension, you not only saved my abstinence, but you saved my life by getting me into sponsoring quickly. But I've always wondered, is that sort of since it was just you are ready, when does that occur? Is it in the middle of the ninth step, or is
it? No. When you're in the middle of the ninth step, you should already be doing a lot of tens and a lot of 11s, and by definition, 12. You don't stop to finish your ninth step before moving on. There are references to 11 in 9, and there are references to 12 in 10. When I go to step 9, and I go to page 83, there is a line in the very first paragraph of the page. It says, so we clean house with the family. I'm on page 83, top paragraph, at the end of that paragraph. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation. So it indicates here, while I'm doing step 9, I'm doing step 11, that our Creator, God, show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. That's a reference to step 10. So we do not stagnate our recovery. We move forward briskly. We work the program together. So you have a reference to 11 and a reference to 10 and 9. Now let's take a look at the page 84, and it says here very quickly, we're on step 10 here. It says, I'm at the see the paragraph that begins, this thought brings us to step 10? Go to the last, or the second to the last sentence of that paragraph, the sentence that starts with, then we resolutely means with purpose, turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Step 12. So if you're in 9, you should be doing 10s and 11s, and you should be out into 12. While you're finding people for your ninth step, you move forward. One of the biggest mistakes I see in OA today are people doing the program much, much too slowly. Much too slowly. I speak to people all the time, and they tell me they have been abstinent for 2-3 months. And I'll say, what step are you on? They'll say 2, 3, 4. Andale, schnell, let's go. No reason to make this into something that it's not. You've got the rest of your life to teach it and study it in depth. Clancy Imisland, one of my heroes, Clancy is dead now. He was in AA. But Clancy said, you do not learn the program by absorbing spiritual information. You learn it by transmitting spiritual information. What does that mean? Go out there and teach this to somebody else. Yes, you go through the steps very quickly. And if you're one of mine, you go through very, very quickly. And then you teach it to other people. That's why you're ready. You move through quickly. Don't stop. Don't stagnate. Don't wait till you're done with 9 to move forward. I hope that helps, Vanessa.
Thank you, Vanessa G. On to Melissa C., followed by Cheryl
Melissa
A.
C. All right.
Hey, good morning. Thanks so much, Leanne. Thanks, oh gosh, thanks, Harlan, for all your incredible service. I'm Melissa Sam, a recovered compulsive overeater in New York. And, you know, I was thinking a lot about, you know, that question that Pete seems to ask a lot about, you know, which kind of leads me thinking about my own relationship with humility, and that I need to invite other people in order to kind of have a, you know, a sense of honesty with myself, that if I fail to invite other people into my inventory process, you know, my appraisal is insufficient, because I think I'm justified in all my resentments. And so my question is really for you, because you do such enormous service in our fellowship, do you find that it's difficult for you to have a relationship with other people where they are comfortable and free to kind of call you out on your crap? Because I need that, and I was just curious about your own experience with that.
Well, I have quite a number of people in my life that will call me out on my crap, Melissa. I have no shortage of that. Trust me on that one. I have people in my life that will gleefully, gladly, happily, euphorically call me on my crap. But you have to know that it is vital for my survival to have my crap called, not in a vicious way, not in a mean, destructive way. I have a sponsor. He is wonderful. He is a wonderful, wonderful guy, and he has no problem yelling at me. He has no problem telling me, you know, this is just pure balderdash. So, yeah, it is important to surround yourself with people that are objective, that are able to do that. And God has provided me with no shortage of that. So, yes, it is important. And we get humbled, you know, as human beings. I go out into the world and they don't know that I'm Harlan G of Scottsdale and that I do this and I do that. No, they don't know, and they don't care. And they don't care. So I have to wait in line, and I have to take my turn, and I'm just another bozo on the bus, you know? And when I get full of myself, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. And what it really boils down to is, am I willing to hear the voice? Am I willing to hear that still small voice that says, you're not a big shot. You're just another bozo on the bus. Don't get so full of yourself, Harlan G. Don't get so full of yourself, because it's the shortest road between where you are and Doritoville and Oreo Town is through comparison to other people, through, you know, compare and despair, or to think that I'm the cat's meow. Those are the shortest distances between me and Doritoville. So I hope that helps.
Thank you, Melissa, for your question this morning. Cheryl A., you're up, and then we'll hear from Connie G.
Hi, everyone. This is Cheryl A. From Brookline, Massachusetts. Good morning, Harlan.
Morning, Cheryl.
It never gets old listening to you. Never.
Thank you.
And it's such an incredible service you do for our fellowship and our program. Okay, here's my topic. When we do direct amends through step 9, there comes a point where our direct amends are done, and I have found that the amends that are still there to make are living amends in the relationships I have, particularly with the people closest to me. And I wanted to hear you talk about living amends and how that works for you. And also, is a living amend really just a 6 and 7 process?
Living amends is more than a 6 and 7 process. I'll take the last part first. Living amends is a change in your behavior, your attitudes, and your ideas. It is a change in how you treat a situation. I am always in the process of making living amends to the people closest to me. Sometimes I say stupid things. Sometimes I do stupid things. Sometimes I have to look at my behavior and I have to say to myself, this has to change. I'm hurting someone or hurting a group of people that I love. This has to change within me. It is so easy for me to look at the behavior of others. And that's so tempting because when I look at the behavior of others, I don't have to look at me. And I would rather hold up the magnifying glass than the mirror. The last tool I want is the mirror. I'd rather look at the magnifying glass. Living amends means I'm going to have to practice patience as well. Because living amends is more than treating someone differently for an hour or a day or a week or a month. It means changing the dynamic in a relationship forever. So it cannot be a temporary fix. Yes, 6 and 7 are important because I want to be rid of these defects. I don't want to be angry. I don't want to be scared. I don't want to be selfish and self-seeking in my relationship or dishonest in my relationships. I don't want those things. There's 5 character defects. I don't want to be any of them. But that takes work and it takes faith that God will do for me what I cannot do for myself. He will change my behaviors if I allow him to. And so I hope that answers it. It is not an event of treating someone well for an hour. It is a lifetime. And if I do it, not only do I get to be closer to them, myself a little less, and I get closer to God. And that's what I really want. Thanks, Cheryl.
Thank you.
I hope that helps.
Thank you. Thank you, Cheryl A. Next, we have Connie G. with a question, followed by Jordan L.
Okay. Connie, I cannot hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you for all of your service, everyone on Vision for You. I do appreciate this program. Mr. Harlan, my question for you, my phone cut out when you were talking about sponsoring. My question for you is this. My sponsor wants me to cut back on the amount of days I call her. And my question is, how often should one call their sponsor? And 2, how often should I call my sponsees? In the beginning, I have my sponsees call me every day until we get through the steps. And then at that point,
I would say, I would say that your sponsor is giving you a very clear signal that they're really not interested in sponsoring you anymore, and I would find someone else. Anybody that tells me not to call them so often, I'm going to find somebody else. You have to exemplify for me that you understand. If you're going to be my sponsor, you have to exemplify for me what I want in this program. I don't want to be sponsored by somebody who says to me, don't call me so often. That is a very clear signal that says, I'm really cutting back on my OA program. I don't want to follow in the footsteps of someone who's cutting back on their OA program. I would find another sponsor yesterday or the day before yesterday. Find someone who accepts your phone call with glee because you are helping God keep them out of the food every day you call. There is no day that I wake up that I am not a compulsive overeater. There's no day that I wake up where I don't need the objective feedback of another human being. And so that's a red flag to me. Somebody says to me, don't call me so often, I'll never call you at all, ever. I won't, because it's a waste of my time. It's a waste of my time. That is not recovery. My sponsees call me every day. Sometimes they'll miss a day here and there. Things happen. Poo-poo happens. They're whatever. I don't miss days. Sometimes I don't get to talk to the person. Sometimes I get voicemail. That happens too. That does happen. And sometimes we don't connect.
But my ego demands that I make that call every single day. If I wake up on a day where I'm not a compulsive overeater, maybe I'll take that day off. But my strong feelings is anybody that says to me, don't call me so often, is not somebody that should be sponsoring me. So I hope that helps.
Thank you, Connie G., for your question. Jordan L., it's your
Jordan L., the pride of Gunnison, Colorado.
There we go.
Hey, good morning, Leia, and good morning, Harlan. It's very good to hear both of your voices live. Harlan, I wanted to ask you a question about experience. So we're in the chapter, There is a Solution Now, in the morning meetings, and those chapters talk a lot about experience. So I wanted to ask you about your experience with being a compulsive overeater, your experience with being in the food, your experience with your experience of God, and your experience of recovery, and how important experience is to this.
About 2 hours here, so
yeah,
Jordan, I will tell you that that is a loaded question. Now tomorrow we are going to read one of the quintessential lines of the Big Book. I don't have time to answer what you've asked me because that would actually take several hours. And I have a lot of recordings on Vision and a lot of recordings on ScottsdaleBigBook.com. ScottsdaleBigBook.com has a couple of hundred of them. And I have many recordings on a Vision for You that will answer, and the LA website. But tomorrow we're going to read a line in the morning that says, we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. We're going to be on page 19 tomorrow. None of us makes a sole vocation of this work. And that line in that paragraph is going to be enough to feast on for the entire 2 hours. I guarantee you there will be no lulls in sharing tomorrow morning. But that line, we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning, means that once the food is down, then we begin to heal in other areas of our life. And your questions are very, very, you know, protracted. I don't have the time to answer them. But my experience is this. I will sum it up for you as best I can. The food is a hell. And as horrible as I imagine hell, I wish it was that nice. Because the food is the absolute dregs of existence. It's not life. To call it a life is an insult to life. And yet I will seek it again because the food gives me 9 seconds of euphoria that Dr. Silkworth calls the effect. But along with the effect, I pay a price that my soul and my heart, my neshuma, my gederim, the Yiddish word of the day is your neshuma. Neshuma is your spirit, your holiness. The Yiddish word of the day today is neshuma. And the holiness that I have in my heart is crushed and set ablaze and degraded and besmirched by the food. It is besmirched by the food. And it is not a life. It is a life of shame and guilt. It is an existence of discomfort and pain and humiliation. And the life of the recovery is the greatest life imaginable. Now, there are some of you listening to this that are in early recovery, and you have not experienced this bliss. Trust me, it's coming, but have reasonable expectations. There's nothing in this book that says, now that I'm not eating Almond Joy bars, everything goes my way. There's nothing in this book that says that. And no matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of human being. And as a human being, I'm going to have ups and downs. This is a life worth living. It is a life of unbelievable bliss. It is a life that is enviable, and it is a life beyond your wildest dreams. Roseanne S., Roseanne Scholar, the founder of OA, wrote a book, Beyond Our Wildest Dreams. I am in places today, romantically, financially, every way you can imagine, health, I can't get to without holding God's hand. I can't get to those places without God. And it is the greatest way of life imaginable. Do I have bad days? Yes. Do things always go my way? No. But on the whole, this is the best life I've ever had. I don't want it to end. I just turned 70. I know I don't have a lot of time left, but I don't have a lot of time left this morning either. But I know, Jordan, that this is the greatest way of life imaginable. And I don't have time to keep expounding on that answer, but I hope that that helps. Thanks.
Thank you, Jordan L. Okay, we have time for one, maybe two more questions. Star one to unmute if you'd like to pose a question.
Sonia S. from Pennsylvania.
Carolyn S.
Maximo.
Tony B.
I got somebody Maximo. From Pennsylvania.
Sonia S. Sonia S. from Pennsylvania.
Julie M.
Go right ahead.
New York.
Sonia S. and then Maximo, please.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Harlan, for your powerful message. What really stood out to me is when you said that this is a disease of self-loathing. And I was wondering, does that feeling ever creep up now that you're recovered? And if so, what do you tell yourself and how do you work through it?
You work through it by helping someone else. You work through it by getting out of yourself. I'm human, so when things don't go my way or when I feel that God is taking something away from me that I want to keep or giving me a burden that I don't want to bear, it will sometimes creep in, but it doesn't last very long, and I have to keep working at it and working at it and working at it. And the way I work against self-loathing is to serve God. And in serving God, I like myself more. And when I say I serve God, what I specifically mean is sponsoring, getting out of myself, answering questions, and taking outreach calls. I get a lot of outreach calls directed at me. I cannot lose my patience. I cannot lose my temper. I cannot think any question or any situation is bad. I have to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. And when I do that, I don't hate myself. I love God and I love life. And I have to take action. This is not a program for people who want it. This is not a program for people who need it. This is a program for people who do it. It is an action program. And action is needed in every one of these situations. I cannot sit here and fight the food. I cannot sit here and fight self-loathing. I cannot sit here and fight my lack or my reluctance to certain things. I have to take action. That's how I do it. Action. What action? Help someone else. Get out of yourself. No mention of yourself. Be of service. No expectation of results. No expectation of a return. I hope that helps. We don't have much time left.
Thank you, Sonia S. And our final question for today comes from Maximo. Your question, please.
Hi. Good morning. Yes, my question is, what Harlan suggests for someone who speaks Spanish to have Rocket to sponsor someone in English? I've been having a hard time to find someone that needs my help, or I can help them in Spanish, but it's difficult for me to speak English.
No, it should be pretty easy. Here's what you do, very simply. Go to Spanish-speaking meetings online. put yourself out there as a Spanish-speaking sponsor. One of the biggest intergroups in the world is the intergroup in Mexico City. There are people on our line. There are people in our Vision for You family that are Spanish speakers that can turn you on to others. Reach out to other people that are not within the United States. Reach out to people in Spanish-speaking countries. Put yourself out there. You have the world today. You know, when I was, for the first 40 years that I was in OA, we went to meetings that were in our neighborhood, in our area. Today, I go to meetings that are virtual, and there are phone meetings like Vision, where you have access to the entire world. You can easily put yourself out there in Spanish-speaking countries. You have, if you have a computer, and I assume you do, if you have a cell phone, and I assume you do, get out there and put yourself out there in areas where there are Spanish speakers, and it should not be even a slight problem, not even a slight problem.
Thank you, Maximo, for your question. And, of course, thank you, Harlan. It's always such a delight and a pleasure to spend some time with you. Thank you for all that you do for A Vision for You and the OA community around the globe. Thank you for this inspiring and instructive morning together. Very valuable, and, of course, it'll be a gem in our archive. The share ID for today's presentation, 21,452. That's 21452. And we're going to close now from page 164. Of course, you know that it's in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.